Blog Talk Radio.
Today on Backroom Politics, the Israeli question: does the AIPAC rhetoric between President Obama and Prime Minister Netanyahu, can the Palestinian-Israeli talks survive? The G8 summit is going to be very tense with the latest fiscal crisis grabbing the world economy. Does the Patriot Act work and should it have been continued? And the 2012 ticket continues to get narrowed down on the GOP side. This is Backroom Politics. America's roundtable of political discussion. This is Backroom Politics live from Shelley's Backroom, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C., live on Blog Talk Radio. Joining me as they are every Tuesday is the 8-term former member of Congress. He is the former vice president of Burlington Northern Railroad for government affairs. He is the Honorable Congressman Al Swift. Congressman, welcome back.
I wish you an honorable good day.
Ah, thank you, sir. Just sitting directly opposed from me in his normal Tuesday seat, he is the former staff chief for Congressman Gerald Ford, former vice president of government affairs for National Broadcasting Corporation. He is the former board member of the National Association of Broadcasters. He is the Honorable Bob Hines. Why did you shiver, Bob? Did I get the Gerald Ford thing wrong again?
Yes.
Oh, God.
I was never his chief of staff.
He
was too smart to do that.
On his way to France, I believe, for the G8 conference, is our international pundit, Dr. Ralph Winnie. We'll be getting some updates from Ralph as his tour of the G8 summit continues. But an electric day here in Washington, D.C. today. The real big news coming out of the nation's capital, as has been going on all week, has been the visit of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu of Israel here to Washington. And during his time here in Washington, there's been some tense discussions, to say the least, between the president and the prime minister at the White House. And there's also been a little bit of a rhetoric war going on between the White House and Tel Aviv at the annual AIPAC summit, which happens here in Washington, D.C. every year. AIPAC, for those of you who don't know, inside the Beltway, is a political action committee based on Friends of Israel. It is a pro-Israeli, pro-Jewish government political action committee. Huge, huge fundraiser. For not only the Democrats, but the Republicans of late have been seeing a strong push from AIPAC as well. But the news today is President Benjamin Netanyahu spoke to a joint session of Congress today, and the reports coming out of the chamber was it was packed. No staffers allowed. It was lawmakers only, and just about every seated member of Congress was in the chamber today. A lot of things he covered, but the big item that he said in his speech today in talking about the Israeli-Palestinian negotiations, will they come back to the table, the comment of Prime Minister Netanyahu is Jerusalem must never again be divided, that Israel would be generous on the size of the Palestinian state, but they would be very careful where they put the border, which refers back to President Obama's comments at the AIPAC session, where he called for Israel to go back to pre-1967 borders, and that is back previous to the Six-Day War of 1967. So big news coming out of this. It was a 40-minute speech, and it has been well-received here in Washington, but the Palestinians are already calling out this is an act of war. I go to you, Al. Al, you've seen other heads of state give an address to the joint sessions of Congress. This is a huge bully pulpit for the Prime Minister, is
yes,
it not?
Yes, it is. As it has been for many other heads of state, particularly when they are currently very popular. The President of Poland,
Lech Walesa.
Was wonderful, and when Jewish Prime Minister and the King of Jordan made a joint appearance.
That would have been Menachem Begin King Hussein.
No, but it was King Hussein, and it was the one who was assassinated. Why can't
it's Yitzhak Rabin.
Yes,
Yitzhak Rabin and King Hussein.
Hugely influential.
Well, you know, and by the way, for those of you who are out there that wish to join the conversation, you can dial in 619-638-8477. Again, the call-in number, 619-638-8477. Bob, how important is the Israeli question to the overall foreign affairs strategy out of the White House and in Congress?
Well, first of all, we have to understand that it's the only, quote, Western democracy in the Middle East. That's always been important by itself. Secondly, in American politics, the Jewish influence within America has been important for both parties. Both parties have had a real strong feeling about supporting Israel. And both parties have said many times, when asked, that Israelis are going to be protected by the United States from any problems. We're going to support them in their trying to work with the Arab neighbors of theirs, trying to find regular borders, trying to decide what the borders ought to be, how Jerusalem should be dealt with, and settlements should be dealt with, and inevitably the American political parties come down on the side of Israel when there are debates on these issues in the Middle East.
So, Al, when we do talk about, and Bob brings up the valid point of, there's always been this underlying almost foreign policy of an attack on Israel is, in fact, an attack on the U.S. We've heard several presidents going back all the way back to President Nixon, who has stated that an attack on Israel is, in fact, an attack on America. But it seems like the Obama White House has backed away from that. What would be... the driving force behind that?
I wonder, I've been calling for politicians in this town to get some guts, particularly over the financial situation and the need to cut spending and so forth. I fail to understand. I think I need to took guts or a lot of stupidity to challenge the American Jews with this policy statement. Because I don't think Obama is stupid. I must admit that I cannot define for myself what he sees as a political gain here, or why he is willing to blow so much political goodwill.
Bob?
Let me just, and I am speculating here, but I think that the Arab Spring, as it is popularly called, the difficulties that autocratic governments in the Middle East are having these days. Some presidents and autocrats have already left government. Others are going to. We're fighting in Libya. Syria is is having lots of disputes. I think that it may well be that, and I'm just speculating, that it may be that the administration is beginning to believe that they need to take a more even-handed approach between Arab nations that are moving toward his hope of a more democratic Middle East, which will mean that it will be less likely to have uprisings and problems. And it could mean that because the Arab nations are moving possibly toward more democratic, free societies, they and the Israelis will be able to get along together better, and he wants to help that happened by trying to be more even-handed. Speculation only on my part.
Al, you're kind of cringing at that thought process. What are you thinking?
Well, I'm not disagreeing with Bob at all. it just seems to me that if that's what they're thinking, that's a little wrong-headed. The administration, it seems to me that they could have achieved the purpose that Bob just outlined, to try to move along the spring in Arabia, by just leaving things with Israel alone for a little while. It seems to me that this puts a big spark in a place, in a room full of gas, and I fail to understand the timing or the purpose of this.
Well, I want to talk. Go ahead, Bob.
Well, I think Al is exactly right. I think that even assuming that what I have postulated is true, it seems to be premature.
Yeah.
Well, you know, and we'll talk about the political ramifications of what's going on, but it strikes me as odd that he is doing it in an election year where arguably the White House is vulnerable right now. I would think that with the strong base of electorate that the Jewish community brings to the Democratic Party, particularly in places like New York, Florida,
California,
you would think that with the money and the votes that are there, this is not exactly the right time to make what could be considered a gutsy foreign policy move. So we'll talk about the political ramifications, but when we look at the Israeli question, one of the comments that we've heard out of an Israeli official was, look, we did not fight the Six-Day War to give back what we gained. Is that a logical point of view to take when talking about the Palestinian question, Bob?
Well, the Six-Day War was fought, 40 years ago?
Yeah, 1967.
Yeah. We're talking an awful long time ago, and I'm not so sure that, you know, while that may be a good rallying cry, I'm not so sure that it necessarily is a policy that one can say that has to be one of our core beliefs. Everybody has known since they stopped fighting over there that borders between the Israelis and other countries around them are going to have to be adjusted at some point. We've always known that. We just don't talk about it in specific terms, like, say, going back to the 1967 borders.
I think there is one bad guy in all of this going back to them. One bad guy.
Who's that?
I'm not particularly fond of Netanyahu and others, and the others I disagree with, but that was the little guy with the turban. Yasser Arafat was, in my judgment, a gutless wonder who would play us along as far as he could and then cut it off.
Yeah, just bail out.
And I remember Abba Eben's comment about Yasser Arafat. He said he never missed an opportunity to miss an opportunity.
Right.
And I wonder if there hadn't been Yasser Arafat, if somebody a little more stable, a little more politically secure than he was, and with a little more guts, had been active on the Arab side during that period, if we wouldn't have an easier situation to deal with today.
Well, you know, we look at the prime ministers who have gone through the years and in the time that the Israeli and Jewish state has been a recognized sovereign entity by mostly, we'll call it what it is, the UN is the one that's the baseline for this. But in the years, you know, we look back at somebody like Golda Meir notably took a hard stance on Palestinian terrorists, but was willing to negotiate about the thought process of a Palestinian state. Now, I believe my history is correct on that. We move forward and we look at, you know, prime ministers like Menachem Begin. Menachem Begin, who was tough, again, tough on terrorism, but willing to sit down at the table, as he demonstrated in the 70s with Jimmy Carter under the Anwar Sadat negotiations.
Right.
As we move forward, we look at Yitzhak Rabin, whose life was taken as a result of his liberal stance on the creation of a Palestinian state.
Right.
Now it seems like we've gone to the complete opposite end in Benjamin Netanyahu. And he's got the support of the Israeli electorate, but is Benjamin Netanyahu going to the far right of right going to be an accurate survival plan for a solid, sovereign, and safe Israeli state.
That is what has always bothered me about Netanyahu, that he didn't know when to stop moving right. On the other hand, for a long time, he had very little support out of the Israeli people, and that's where Yasser Arafat comes in. How many times could that guy, you know, screw over in negotiations and whatever the Israeli people without them getting angrier and angrier and moving more to the right, to the point now that Netanyahu is very popular.
Bob. Well, it strikes me that the fact that the PLO and the political arm,
Hamas.
Yeah. And you know, Hamas and the Palestinian Authority, which is Abbas, I think, is
right,
the leader there.
Mahmoud Abbas.
Yeah, they are now going to form one government. Now, exactly what that means, I don't think anybody knows quite now.
Well, I think
a terrorist organization, by definition, Hamas, is now a part or is about to become a part of the governmenting and the political structure of the Palestinian Authority. Now, that is kind of scary. That's like bringing the mafia into the police force and wondering what the problem is. How are you going to work that out?
Go ahead, Al.
That's true. It's possible that by having them on the inside of the tent, they can be moderated by the others rather than radicalizing.
Well, you know, a funny comparison was made, and it blew my mind when I first heard it, but the more I think about it, it is not unlike bringing the IRA and Sinn Féin in to deal with the troubles in Northern Ireland. When they brought in Sinn Féin and when they brought the IRA and Sinn Féin in to help govern Northern Ireland in a peaceful existence, violence decreased.
You know, that's
so it's an odd comparison, but
it's a good analogy to it. I can see that. Yeah, but I'm still a little more concerned.
Go ahead.
You still want to count the cards.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah. But, you know, using that logic, now the one thing I will state is, you know, the IRA and Sinn Féin were never as hugely radicalized.
No.
You didn't have human bombs with the IRA. Now, they use explosives, but you never saw them as militant or as radicalized as the Palestinian organization.
The disagreements were never as deep, if you will. Deep as they were never as deep as the Arab-Israeli disputes are.
Well, it was religious. I mean, you know, the IRA was just a matter of sovereignty, one island, whereas this is now a religious issue.
Yeah, it was a political issue in Northern Ireland.
Correct. But, you know, when we look at bringing in Hamas and Fatah, creating a coalition government in the Palestinian Authority, and possibly the governing body of a Palestinian state, you know, Benjamin Netanyahu is obviously going to take a hard line because of his military history. For those who don't know, Benjamin Netanyahu was a long-term military officer and a senior military officer in the Israeli Defense Force, was actively involved in the raid on Entebbe back in the 1970s against Idi Amin. He is a hawk when it comes to defending Israel and the post-1967 borders. But we also saw somebody very similar. His counterpart was Moshe Dayan. Moshe Dayan, who was a longtime Israeli defense senior officer who ended up becoming prime minister, never took the hard line that Benjamin Netanyahu. Can Benjamin Netanyahu take a lesson from a Moshe Dayan, or did I go back all to my ear?
Well, it's certainly easier for someone who has taken a very strong position in a major issue to soften it in a negotiation because his or her credibility is already definitively set. I mean, people say, well, look, you know, Netanyahu is, you know, one of these guys who has stood up to all the problems and the crazy Arabs as much as we can stand. He's always been with us. If he thinks it's okay to do something, it must be all right to do it.
Al, do you think that this is, in fact, just rhetoric, pre-conference rhetoric, and saying, I'm going to hold my stance until I get to the negotiation tables?
I think that the Carter statement may have turned it from that to something a little more serious. Just parenthetically, the analogy you made between the two Palestinian leaders, I would ask the question, could Douglas MacArthur have ever learned anything from Dwight Eisenhower?
Very valid point. If you're a fan of MacArthur would tell you absolutely not. He knew everything. It's 20 past the hour. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to still talk about the Israeli question and President Obama's response to what's been happening here with AIPAC and the Israeli question. This is Backroom Politics live on Blog Talk Radio from Shelley's Back Room. Stay with us. Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., America's premier cigar lounge. And as Bob likes to say, the place to be. This is Backroom Politics live from Shelley's Back Room on Blog Talk Radio. We're going to continue the discussion of the Israeli question that has been resurfaced as a result of the state visit of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and the tense meeting that he had with President Obama at the White House the other day. Now, the meeting of President Obama and Prime Minister Netanyahu came on the heels of President Obama's speech on the Israeli question, where he originally called out, it was a speech given at the State Department, which is a very odd venue to bring this up in the first place, but it was done nonetheless. And it was the Foggy Bottom speech, that everybody's calling it, that called into question Israel going back to the pre-1967 land borders. And that was a day before the arrival of Prime Minister Netanyahu. The meeting was, from all accounts, tense, awkward. and the speeches and the rhetoric that has gone on afterwards, some have criticized Prime Minister Netanyahu of saying that his rhetoric has been almost lecturing President Obama, which some in Washington have not taken kindly to. Quick question, though, to Al. Do you think that the statements and the presentations by Prime Minister Netanyahu, do you think that they were lecturing or just holding firm?
I think the intent was to hold firm, and if it became sounding like lecturing, I think he really wanted to make the president understand how strongly he opposed the president's ideas. Netanyahu was never going to win the prize for diplomacy, and he didn't this time. But what that ultimately means, I'm not sure. You mentioned something earlier that I thought was interesting. Was the president trying to do this to help encourage the reforms in the other Arab countries? Let me turn it around and ask this. If the other Arab countries finally become democratized, the ones that are still up in the air and so forth, wouldn't it then change the whole dynamic of the Israeli-Arab conflict substantially, bringing a lot more direct allies and democratically based allies into support of the Arab position? And that, it would seem to me, if that's what could happen, would be Netanyahu's worst nightmare.
Bob, what do you think?
Well, I think that we have said that it was a very tense meeting between the two leaders. I think I found what was interesting was that in spite of that, on both the United States and the Israeli side, the spokespeople, the press people, both on both sides tried to play down the dispute and tried to point out how much cooperation, how much together they are. That doesn't change the fact that the president is the first president of the United States to ever say publicly that the beginning of the negotiations has to be the
1967 border question.
The 67 border question. Everybody has always known that that is the fundamental place we're going to have to start. But they have never said it openly because it's a question of, are you going to give it away right now, or are you going to give it up with negotiations as you work your way through all the other border changes that are going to have to be made with respect to how much of Jerusalem is going to be Arab and how much is Israeli and how much settlements are going to be moved and how many aren't going to be moved. There's a whole lot of moving parts here. Well, and when you give something away as important as the border question, that's a big giveaway.
Well, you know, it's funny, Al, because here in Washington, D.C., for those of you who are not inside the Beltway, a lot of rhetoric has been going on regarding the question of the Israeli settlements. One of the items that was brought up, the 67 border question, has been brought up as the key focal point of the Foggy Bottom speech by President Obama. But he also touched on the fact that, and I'm going to paraphrase, that occupation is not the right idea to negotiate. And President and Prime Minister Netanyahu has stated publicly he will not back down from Israeli settlements. No. It is our territory. We want it fair and square. Live with it.
That's where I think the president was right. And if he had not said 1967 and instead focused on the settlements question, I think he would have got a lot farther.
And Benjamin Netanyahu is reversing a lot of the original policies on settlement. It was Yitzhak Rabin who took a very liberal position on settlements, actually knocked down some of the settlements in Gaza, and was willing to talk about the Gaza border, where it stands, where it sits, and to even some extent talk about Jerusalem as an option. I will tell you right now, just to put on my pundit hat, it strikes me is that we will never see Jerusalem in our time, at least, or in the near 100 years. Jerusalem will not be the center of government, will not be the capital of an Israeli state. I just don't think, with Christians involved, with Jews involved, and with Muslims heavily involved, Jerusalem is going to be one of those. It's almost like they should make it a city-state unto itself without bringing into question a division, the Jewish side. All it's doing is carving it up like Berlin, and we see how successful that was.
Well, the biggest cheer that Netanyahu got, I think, I didn't hear it all, but I think the biggest cheer he got in his speech today was he said that Jerusalem will always be a Jewish city. It's going to be our capital. And that's throwing
gas on the fire.
Gas on the fire, yeah.
When you look at the Jerusalem question, I mean, Tel Aviv is taking a very hard line on Jerusalem. In your years of being in Congress and being updated on some of these foreign affairs policies, is that a non-starter? I mean, are we literally just spitting in the wind right now when it comes to Jerusalem as far as an American position goes?
Well, it seems to me that Netanyahu's position on Jerusalem is unsustainable. When you've got the three religious groups that have just been listed here, something along the lines of what you suggested, a city-state or something like that, makes a heck of a lot more sense. If Israel was ever successful in being able to claim that it was their capital, I think you would soon have armed conflict over that.
I agree with that.
I don't think they can politically protect that position.
And go ahead, Bob.
Well, it's considering the fact that three of the major religions in history all have core reasons to feel that Jerusalem is important to them for historic reasons. It strikes me, Justin, of what you're saying about the fact that it's got one way or another, Jerusalem has got to be open,
right,
to the availability of all three religions to have some impact, some authority, some opportunities within what we would call Jerusalem.
Right, and we see a city state, to put my pun in and take off my moderator hat, we've seen a successful city state in the Vatican. Now, I'm not comparing Jerusalem to the Vatican. Vatican is the holy ground of the Roman Catholic religion. But the success of the Vatican being a city state, it has its own embassy here, it has its own embassy and direct relations with the UN. I don't think that Jerusalem becoming a city state, which would be ultimately overseen or governed by a coalition of Muslims, Catholics, and Jews, or Muslims, Christians, and Jews, I don't think that that's necessarily out. And yet it strikes me that nobody's really taken a hard look, at least that I know of calling Jerusalem what it should be, is a religious center, not a capital city. Bob, would you agree with that?
Well, nobody's talking about it in any way except the capital city. And I don't know that you're – let's put it this way. I don't know about the Christians, but I don't think the Arabs and the Muslims – I don't think the Muslims and the Jews can ever – join that closely together in a coalition government. I do think that there are ways to – there are parts of Jerusalem that are clearly more Christian than they are
Jewish or Muslim.
And there are certainly areas that are more Jewish and more Muslim than others. So it seems to me that at least in a preliminary sense, you could begin to say we're all going to cooperate together – but you're in charge of your piece, and I'm in charge of mine, and we'll have some over group that help us. We all put together, like, maybe a police force that all covers every place.
Do we put it under the auspices of the UN? Do we make the UN the governing body that governs Jerusalem as a holy historical site, not so much a capital city?
What I like about that is it then turns the governance of Jerusalem back to a political process rather than a religious
process.
Right.
Yeah.
As long as you're going to fight this out on religious grounds and religious philosophy, you're never going to get anywhere.
You're never going to solve it.
No.
And I was sitting here thinking, but how would you ever move it to a political process? And you may just have come up with an idea that would work then.
So how is it that, rhetorical question. How is it that three guys smoking cigars and having drinks at a cigar lounge broadcasting on an internet radio station can come up with these ideas, yet the folks in Foggy Bottom, the folks in Tel Aviv, and the folks at the UN in New York haven't even thought about the possibility of that?
May I make a suggestion?
Yes.
It may very well be that wiser men and women than us have always have thought about these things privately and been beat over the head about what a stupid idea that is. But we're just three guys who don't have any responsibility.
Al, you have a comment to take back the backhanded compliment we got from our colleague?
I think the fact that the people you mentioned may say those three guys don't know what they're talking about. But sometimes, and I found this working with the constituents,
mm-hmm.
sometimes a guy, a longshoreman or a guy working at the mill or something would come up with an idea that was really not bad. Now, I could see as a politician there are enormous difficulties in making it happen, but often I wouldn't have any problem with it happening if we could figure out how to make it do it.
Right.
And so I think to that degree, having some people that don't know all the reasons why you can't do something might come up with useful and positive suggestions.
Well, let's talk a little bit about something that we touched on in the first segment, but it's definitely worth discussing, is the issue of the political backlash from this. Again, the amount of money that AIPAC and the Jewish political community brings to the table, as well as the number of votes that AIPAC and the Jewish political community brings to the table, particularly for the Democrats, is mind-boggling. Why would he throw vinegar in the well at this stage when the White House is, in fact, vulnerable? It doesn't make political sense to me. Am I wrong in this, Al?
Doesn't make any sense to me.
What possible reasons, Bob, can you see that he would want to spark this fire?
The only one that I can see is that as a policy matter, as we were talking earlier with the Arab Spring and what that could mean, he is trying to get ahead a little bit and try to find a way to lead to a better, safer Middle East for everybody. I think it's premature. I think it's too early, and I think politically, I think it's quite foolish, because between now and the election, the chances of anything good happening in the Middle East is not particularly high. We've been dealing with this question for 16 years. Why would it get better in the next 16 months? I can't see why.
Well, this would not be the first time the Democrats did something that was politically stupid, but very, very arguably the right policy. And I'm thinking of Lyndon Johnson and the Civil Rights Movement, which essentially lost for the Democrats the solid Democratic South.
Right.
It's become the solid Republican South.
Lucky they were.
Bob, for those of you
who heard a little whisper, that was a snarky comment from our comrade here, Bob Hines and Al Swift. But, Al, you bring up a good point. The Civil Rights Act lost a lot of blue dots, a lot of votes.
Yeah,
and it probably didn't gain that much because the African Americans were largely on the side of the Democrats to begin with. But here you have the Jewish Americans who have been largely on the side of the Democrats historically,
and who vote.
So let's assume for a moment that the president's aims are perfectly noble and rational, and that it's good policy. But he's just carving off another big hunk of Democratic votes and sending them elsewhere.
Well, I mean,
this isn't the time for something like this.
No, something is radical, which arguably this decision was. Well, for both presentations, the one at AIPAC and at the Foggy Bottom speech, were arguably very radical. But was it, in your opinion, Al and Bob, was it radical enough to possibly cost him the White House?
Well,
there are so many other factors that are going to go into that it would have to be an awfully thin margin for this to be seen as the reason to do it.
Yeah,
but it is not going to be helpful.
No. Certainly, it's not going to turn the Jewish vote, which is generally Democratic, into a Republican vote. It could lessen the amount of enthusiasm that the Jewish vote has, both monetarily and as voters.
Well, you've got players out there, like most notably Joe Lieberman, a noted proponent of the Jewish state, who has arguably been in the middle of the aisle, could actually gain support for a Republican Jewish vote.
Well, I now know what Obama should do next to just completely settle this.
What's that?
And that is, he should join all those Catholics that say that the Republicans, the Republican Catholics, are not abiding by Catholic philosophy in terms of social welfare and so forth, and get that boiling in the Catholics.
There's a bunch of professors at the Catholic University of America who did exactly that when Boehner gave his commencement speech to Catholics.
That's my point. And so you jump on that, and
you can really get the hot.
You're hitting all on all.
Yeah.
Let's take a break. It's twenty till the hour. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk about the fiscal instability of the global economy yet again. The G8 summit is coming out, and Nash is pouring us some more drinks, and we got to thank Nash. Nash helps us set up every time,
and she takes
good care of us here at Backroom Politics.
She's beautiful, too.
That's right. This is Backroom Politics live on Blog Talk Radio from Shelley's Backroom in Washington, D.C. We'll be back in 2 minutes. Stay with us. Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, America's premier cigar lounge. This is Backroom Politics live on Blog Talk Radio. We're going to continue the discussion right now.
I have a question.
Go ahead, Al.
Who is the music director on this program?
That would be me, Al.
Well, I hate to compliment you, but I think the music is excellent.
We've actually gotten compliments on the music that we put in break. Normally, if this was a for-profit radio show, we would have advertising. But we figure, hell, since we're not making money on this, we'll go ahead and put in some decent music. That one you just heard was Groovin' by Charlie Parker, which is fantastic, fantastic piece of music. We're big fans of Charlie Parker, Duke Ellington, who is a D.C. native, and Kid Ory, who is a great ragtime performer from back in the 20s. But thank you very much. I appreciate that. That's very kind of you. Let's talk a little bit about what's going on globally right now. The global financial crisis continues to take a nosedive. The G8 is now getting ready to convene in Paris, France. And it couldn't have happened at a better time. And by the way, for those of you guys who are listening out in Radio Land, if you'd like to join our conversation, any topic is available. You can call us at 619-638-8477. Again, that number is 619-638-8477. With the G8 convening in Paris, and there's going to be a full agenda, I'm sure, for those discussions, we're seeing a time when the EU, the stability of the EU monetary unit and the EU as an economic power, starting to falter a little bit. Greece continues to fall into financial turmoil. It just got worse this week. There's a lot of instability in the streets of Greece, to the point where it was said publicly that if you wanted to buy a Greek island, they're willing to talk. The Greek islands are now for sale. You can get your own little island in Greece for a bargain right now. But seriously, Ireland's economy has now been downgraded as of today. They have now downgraded Ireland to a negative, which is not helpful for the EU or for the financial stability globally. With the G8 coming together, Bob, when we look at everything going on, and by the way, for you Americans that are out there, we're also looking at last week, we actually hit our debt ceiling. We are done in August. Unless we raise the debt ceiling come August, we're going to start defaulting on a bunch load of payments back to the financial markets. So when we look at all of this, Bob, is this G8 summit as critical as it seems? Well, is the timing on this that huge?
Well, you take a look at Western Europe. Democratic nations, a number of them under, particularly, we've talked about Greece, Portugal, and Ireland are all, on the table as, on the operating table. Almost all of them are having terrible problems. Italy is practically broke. Spain is not doing that well. The northern part of the EU, the Scandinavian countries and Germany and France are all in pretty good shape, but they have attempted to find ways to support Greece, Portugal and Italy, and Ireland, and it's not working. It hasn't been enough, and it hasn't worked.
Well, the question comes up, Al. One of the discussion points that we heard today that the EU and even the G8 is going to be wrangling over is the thought that they may have to, because of the financial instability, kick Greece out of the EU, and there's even talk about kicking Ireland out of the euro. Does that make financial sense to you, Al, or is that just a knee-jerk reaction?
Listen, you're talking to a guy who can't balance his checkbook.
But politically, this has got to be something that's going to resonate globally.
Well, it is, and it jeopardizes, it seems to me, the EU in general. Let me step back just a little bit. Democracy is a form of government that makes it very easy for governments to give the citizens things. It's a form of government that makes it very hard to take things back. And as in the deep, deep, deep trouble that Greece was in, and they tried to take some things back, and there were people in the streets and whatever, and they didn't seem to understand why these things were necessary. And I wonder, why is that? Why did they spend themselves into this hole? And the liberals and the conservatives, I think, both share some blame here. In this, I've always said that that particularly looking at the United States welfare system, I think you had the Democrats there with the donkey. There's a donkey sitting there, and the Democrats are feeding it a carrot, and the Republicans are hitting it with a 2x4. But they're at the wrong ends of the animal. And it doesn't work. Now, here's the question that it's kind of a partisan thing, but why do conservatives always sound so mean when they talk about spending and what have you? They created the welfare queen out of almost nothing. They're really pull yourself up by your bootstraps. Very, very tough talk, very little sympathy, which opens the way for then the Democrats to be very sympathetic and very helpful. And it seems to me that if you had a what was George Bush the two his term of he wasn't soft-hearted conservative.
No, it was a compassionate.
Compassionate conservative.
I never saw it, but it was a great strategy for the Republicans to speak with more compassion and to present their views, which were fiscally more restricted and more conservative, but do it giving a sense that they cared about people. I don't think, in general, Republicans have a very good rating in terms of expressing compassion.
You know, the funny thing about it is when we talk about the democracies that are over there, and you know, arguably Greece is the fundamental heartland of what is today's American democracy. Greece was a socialized state. There was a lot of socialization in medicine, healthcare, a lot of socialization in welfare. There was socialization in industry. At some point, the socialization is what's going to be your spending downfall. And going back to your point, Al, pulling back what you have been given all your life is a tough sell. And yeah. Bob, you got a thought on that?
Well, most of Western Europe have much more of government intervention in the marketplace than we do here in our United States. And most of those governments are having problems with respect to how much they are involved in providing for, you know, pensions, health care, you name it. And it's
long vacations.
Long vacations, retiring at 55 and 60, you know, instead of
right.
You know, and all of them are beginning to look at the fact that they can't do it much longer anymore. I think we're in the same boat. I think the Western society. I think Al's exactly right. We provide things for our citizens, and more and more we're discovering that the costs are beginning to overwhelm us. You know, it tends to be a problem of what you need is you almost have to have every generation that's coming behind you's got to be bigger, because that's the only way, if they're paying into the system, they can take care of their parents' benefits, so to speak. So every generation has to get bigger, and it doesn't work that way.
I've often wondered why we can't use a market concept of investment. And investment suggests that you need at some point in your accounting system to figure out whether you're making any money on it or not.
No.
You can, I think you can make a good case for educational spending in terms of more educated people who get better jobs and pay higher taxes.
Long-term benefits for everybody.
Right.
And so forth. Some of the other things, I think, may not look so good on a cost-benefit ratio. And doing something along those lines, if the conservatives were willing to apply those genuinely, and if the Democrats and the liberals were willing to understand that you can't be solving a social problem at huge debt, but you got to figure out a way to do it so that you're ultimately improving the economy, not hurting it. That might work, but neither party shows any interest in approaching it that way.
Well, you know, we saw some semblance of government. I don't want to call it socialized because it wasn't socialized. I mean, you know, subsidized industry has been a focal point of many, many westernized cultures. It was the downfall of the American maritime community, the American merchant marine, the American shipbuilding community can't compare to the government subsidized shipbuilding in Italy, Sweden, Norway, Korea. But we saw a little bit of a government subsidized in the bailout of the big three car or two of the big three car manufacturers, GM and Chrysler. But we saw the success in that with Chrysler announcing today that it is going to be able to pay back the bailout money in full.
It's possible that the country may make some money on those.
Yeah, which is amazing to me. What it brings into question is there a sustainable way for the countries that we're talking about, i.e. Ireland, Portugal, Greece, Italy to a certain extent, are they going to be able to come out of this tailspin?
Well,
or are we talking about the collapse of major European markets that are critical to the sustainability of the American economy?
I changed the question just a little bit. Are we going to be able to preserve democracy while we're doing that in those countries? Or are you going to, the riots will have to be put down and you're setting a lot of countries up for a man and a white horse to come in.
Well, we're seeing it's almost ironic that today we're seeing strong democracy movements in the Arab Spring, whereas right now we're looking at a possible European fall. You know, there's a lot of the instability of the financial markets in these countries, along with having the direct financial impact that it does on our economy. I mean, you know, the idea of me and going to make light of it, the idea of me paying $150 for a bottle of Sambuca is ludicrous. I'm not going to do that. Your bottle of wine that I still owe you is going to be $1,000. I can't afford that.
I just heard you're not going to get your bottle of wine.
Well, you know, I heard that too some time ago. But you know, the reality is that Europe is very much intertwined
right.
in a whole lot of ways. Now, whether the wealthy northern European countries, the ones that have been much more careful than some of the more southern countries, they have been better at taking care of their own stuff and making sure they're paying their bills and they're functioning in a way that is economically sound. They're not having problems. They're going to have to bail out their colleagues more than they're doing if they're going to save the European Union. And right now, the biggest question is whether Germany is prepared to do anything further, and I don't know whether they are. I think the Germans are feeling that every time they open a window, somebody outside yells and throw us some money because we're in trouble.
Well, you know, it's funny too, because as we look at this, when we look at what's going on in Germany, I mean, Angela Merkel is coming into Washington D.C. for an official state visit. She's going to be in coming early June. That's going to be a topic of discussion that we have to look at is how much can we put on the backs of Germany and the Scandinavian and the Baltic states. You know, we're looking at countries like Latvia, which is seeing a economic renaissance now. They've done it, and that's a former Soviet state. So there's a lot of questions that still have to be answered as we look forward to this. But when we look at the G8, you know, the major players, Germany, France, England, the U.S., Japan is going to be involved, but Japan's got its own issues trying to recover its own natural disasters. So when we look at all the G8 players sitting around the table, all eyes go back in Europe, all eyes go back to Germany, and all eyes are going to continue to look at the United States and how we're going to have to get involved possibly.
And
they're looking at us to see how we're going to handle our own problems.
We've got
true too.
We have a hell of a hole, that, and you know, they say when you're in a hole, stop digging. But we haven't stopped digging.
Yes.
We're still going deeper.
We are still going deeper.
Yeah, I mean, we're doing exactly the wrong thing. We're not solving our problems.
Well, and it brings me back to what I was saying before. If you have fundamental economic collapse, what was the situation that allowed Adolf Hitler to come to power? What was the economic situation that allowed Mussolini to come to power? What was the economic situation in our country that allowed Huey Long to become a serious threat to President Roosevelt?
Right.
Economic problems.
Economic problems. So the democracies that I think we tend to assume will just go on forever are now at a point where they got to take things away. That's going to make people mad. That means that it's less likely that the steps that are necessary to be taken will be taken, and that leads you to economic chaos.
Are we on the cusp of looking at another Franco in Spain? Are we looking at another Greek Revolution? Is that a possibility in your eyes, Bob? I mean, not to call into your age and your accounts of history, but you've been around to see a lot of this.
Well, it's clear to me that a number of European countries are in a situation where they can't pay their bills and they're not going to get any more support from some of the wealthier EU countries unless they take some very vigorous steps, which will be the second time they've had a close shave in the last 2 or 3 years. And the situation will be ripe for politicians on either the extreme right or the extreme left to come out and say, by God, why should we have to suffer so seriously? Why are these other countries putting such pressure on us to stop what we've been doing when all we've been doing is trying to give money to our citizens, you know, with this program or that program? And they're telling us we have to change our retirement age. We're going to have to cut our pensions. We have to cut our wages. We can't live the way we want to live. Why should we have to do this? I can see half a dozen different countries, you know, a year from now saying things like that.
It's a continuation of the sense of entitlement,
yes,
that we're seeing in a quote-unquote socialized economic state.
Don't think it can't happen here if we don't solve all budget
problems. Wow. I didn't think we were going to be able to tie our issues into it right now. But I will say this, though. It does call into question, you know, looking at Great Britain, who is not a part of the EU, but because of the deep economic ties it has to the rest of the EU, is going to be a directed force. Prime Minister David Cameron's got a huge amount of pressure on his plate here at this upcoming G8 to be able to come up with some solution. Because the rest of Europe, in fact, is going to be looking at Great Britain as a possible help us help you environment that's probably going to come out of it.
And in his government, he has his partner is very left wing.
Correct. Clegg. Minister Clegg is obviously, but he's been ultimately, in my opinion, slowly being neutralized. He wants out of this coalition government, and I would say that Nick Clegg is probably two steps away from saying, look, we're done. I would not be surprised, and we're kind of getting off track a little bit, but it does tie into the question that the economic problems in Great Britain are probably going to call a quicker vote of no confidence than anything going on
Clegg,
right now.
If the Liberal Democrats pull out of the coalition, they'll be out.
Cameron's done.
They're done. Because they'll disappear, because they lost the last election, just the by-elections they had recently, they lost 40-50% of their vote.
That's true.
Well, I think you're both right. They're both done.
Yeah. Yeah. It's going to be interesting. This upcoming G8 is definitely going to have an interesting tone to it, and all eyes are going to be on Paris here over the next week and a half or so. It's now five past the hour. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk about the 2012 GOP ticket again, that is continuing to get smaller and smaller and a lot more interesting. And just as we think it's getting smaller and smaller, there's a couple of new names that pop up. That's going to be some interesting talk. This is Backroom Politics live from Shelley's Backroom in Washington, D.C. Stay with us. Here live in Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street, in the heart of our nation's capital. It's 10 past top of the hour, and joining us as always here on Backroom Politics, he is the former 8-term member of Congress, the former vice president of government affairs for Burlington National Railroad, or Burlington Northern Railroad. He is Congressman Al Swift. Al, welcome back.
Hi, Al. Thank you.
Sitting directly across from me, as he is every Tuesday, he is the former floor chief of Congressman Gerald Ford, former vice president of the National Broadcasting Corporation and former board of director for the National Association of Broadcasters. He is the Honorable Bob Hines. Bob, welcome.
Always glad to be at Shelley's.
Yeah, on his way to Paris by way of New York City and other hub destinations for the airlines is Dr. Ralph Winnie, our international abundant. I'm sure we're going to get a huge report from him when he gets back up for air. And I'm your moderator, Justin Russell. And what we're going to be talking about right now, and by the way, if you'd like to join us on the air, please feel free to call in. The number is 619-638-8477. Again, that number is 619-638-8477. We're going to talk a little bit now, change tracks, and look at the 2012 GOP ticket. We know what the Democratic ticket's going to look like. It's going to be Obama, short of him pulling a Lyndon B. Johnson on everybody, but it looks like the Democratic ticket's set. But the big question now is who's going to go up against President Obama in 2012? The ticket, the names on the tickets have gotten really, really short. At least we thought they were getting shorter. The big surprise was the announcement by former governor, former member of Congress, Mitch Daniels, pulling out of the GOP race as it stands this week. Now, Bob, you're very close to Governor Daniels. What was his thinking, or what do you think was his thinking behind it?
Number one, you're very kind, but I am not close to Governor Daniels, but
you're a big fan of Mitch Daniels.
I am a big fan, and I have, over the last months, I know that our listeners know that, because I have thought that he would be probably a very strong and maybe the best candidate we could put forward.
And I agreed with that.
I am very disappointed that the governor has decided not to put his hat in the ring. I can understand why he did not want to. He's got his wife did not want him to run. He has two daughters who have young children, and he did not want to get the whole family, they did not want to get involved, and he did not want to force them to do it, and he chose his family over the country at the political party, and
sure.
I think that's a legitimate choice.
I think so.
I wish that things had been different in his family, but they're not.
Right.
And so he's not going to run, and I think that means that probably the man who might have had the strongest chance to beat the Democratic Party and the incumbent president is not going to be running.
Al, what are your thoughts on Mitch Daniels? Mitch Daniels was a surprise to a lot of people inside town here.
I have a conspiracy theory here.
What is a conspiracy theory?
Well,
you're not one for being a conspiratist, but we'll hear it.
It's not really a conspiracy theory, but first Haley Barbour and then Daniels. And I said at the time when Barbour pulled out, I think there's a sense among shrewd Republican politicians that this is not going to be their year on the presidential level. I don't know that that's true in the congressional level at all. And Huckabee has also pulled out or didn't get in. Strong candidate again, and I think they figure not go through all of that pain, anguish, and hard work that running for president is not worth it. It ain't just going to happen this year.
But it's funny, just as we think that the ticket is getting smaller, thank you, Joe. Mm-hmm. Joe's just brought me my Jack Daniels. Thank you, Joe. And it looks like Bob's ordering his glass of wine, so... When we thought the ticket was getting smaller, all of a sudden the ticket gets larger. We're hearing three names pop up as possibilities. One of them, Jeb Bush. Now, Bob, you and I before the show were talking about the possibility of Jeb Bush. I've got my own theories from just dealing with the Bush camp when I was in Florida working Tallahassee. Bob, you have some thoughts on that.
I think that Jeb Bush is... I think people who are raising his name are doing it because of the good candidates, as they see it, maybe falling by the wayside or not getting in. And I think they're looking for someone who is a talented, proven, got a good talent and proven record in a state. And Jeb Bush certainly was a very successful governor of Florida.
Very popular.
I don't think he has any interest in running at all.
I can tell you right now with some authority that the possibility... Jeb Bush has traditionally not been looking for the White House, in my opinion. I think that his time came and passed. The legend goes that Jeb was supposed to be the first Bush family member to come in after 41. Jeb was supposed to be 43. And the problem came up when he ran against Lawton Childs in his first gubernatorial race and lost. The RNC came back and said, how can we run Jeb when he lost in his own state? I think that is, I don't know how accurate that is, but that seems to be the tone of urban legends. And I think that because of that, because that he was not 43 and his brother was, that I think that his camp is saying America's not ready for a third Bush White House. And I think he's smart. He's very, very strategic. I think he will be involved in the American political scene somehow, but I just don't see him doing this. So I agree with you, Bob. I agree with you, Al. I think that he's not a non-starter. The other name coming up is Governor Chris Christie. Al, popular governor in New Jersey, Knowles Bart, former U.S. attorney for New Jersey, former prosecutor. He's got a lot of momentum right now, and he's being a surrogate for a lot of Republican races.
Well, and I know that you happen to be a big fan of
huge Chris, fan of Chris Christie. Christie. Yes.
And I value your judgment, so I don't know him well, but if you say this is both a good candidate and a competent governor, I have to take your word for it. But whether he wants to or not, I don't know.
Well, he's already come out and said, I don't think Chris Christie will do it. Bob, you've been following this as well.
I think he's done everything you can do.
Except tattoo it across his chest.
Yeah, except tattoo it or put it on his forehead in a light or something.
Which comes back around to my idea that the smart ones don't think this is the year for Republicans.
Correct.
And that also means, I think, that the third name you're going to throw out, Justin, is also going to dodge.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, the third name that's out there is the governor of the Lone Star State, Governor Rick Perry, Republican governor. Very popular, very successful. A little bit outside the box, going back to his initial days in office where he was calling for Texas to secede from the Union back to Mexico.
I'm for that.
Well, there are Texans that would disagree with you. There are numerous Texans that would disagree with you, Al.
All right.
But Governor Rick Perry's got some momentum. He's an up-and-coming star, arguably, in the Republican Party. He's getting a lot of buzz, and the word on the street out of Austin is he's giving it some serious thought.
Well, how do I say this civilly? Unlike the other two we talked about, who I think are very wise people and maybe seeing this as not the right year, I'm not sure Perry is that deep, and he may go anywhere.
Bob, what do you think?
I don't know enough about Mr. Perry to have a solid opinion of him. I have watched him over the years. Sometimes I thought he was pretty shrewd, and sometimes I thought he was not. But maybe that's true about everybody. But I have a feeling that it won't work for him.
He does. I mean, you know, we have always stated that some of the more successful presidents have been governors, not people from Congress.
Absolutely.
That the governors are the ones that are going to ultimately take the White House successfully. But we look at a governor like Rick Perry. I mean, Texas is dealing a lot with the rest of the states. He's dealing with budget crises. He's starting to manage the budget issues.
Wait. The governor of Texas is a very weak governor. I'm not talking about Perry. I'm talking about the
governor's seat itself.
The governor's seat itself. The lieutenant governor, strangely enough, is the powerhouse in Texas. Bush, too, got away with saying I was the governor, da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And so maybe Perry can do it, too, because most people think a governor is a governor is a governor. But the Texas
he
governor...
He is still the chief executive of that state.
Yeah.
Powerful or not, he is still the ultimate signature authority.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, all that being true, I just don't see him as a... as a guy who could win the nomination, although it is certainly true that the Republicans have more Republican Governor Association, which I think that our friend from Mississippi,
Hilly Barber,
is one of the real powerhouses in that group. Anybody that group of people, the governors, would support as their candidate, as back in 2000. They all went to support, 43. If they do that, they can have a great deal of influence, and they might even be able to win the nomination at the convention. If at the convention no one has a clear shot, nobody is way ahead.
Going back to Christie for a moment, he's young. When he finishes this term, it'll be 2 years away from the next presidential
election. They can run two terms in that state, New Jersey.
And he, I think, would be a hell of a candidate
16 might be his year.
2016.
Yeah. And it also, Christie.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it might also.
And running now and getting beaten isn't going to help him with that.
But what, now, but
one other name I want to just toss out, not because I necessarily think he's a major candidate at this point, but he's in play, and that is former governor of Utah, John Huntsman. He was Mr. Obama's.
Secretary of Commerce.
No, he was the ambassador to China. Ambassador to China. And that might make him suspect in the eyes of some Republicans, although it's not as though he was a policymaker. He was an ambassador, which is a different thing. And
right.
And he speaks Mandarin. He's an obvious choice to be in China. So it made some sense for the administration. But he doesn't have an organization. He's not raising a lot of money. I mean, it's late in the game for a guy who nobody ever heard of outside of Utah. And he's another Mormon, and that might break up the Mormon vote. So I think maybe Romney's already got that one. So I just don't know.
I think Romney by default will be the nominee.
Well, but I mean, Huntsman's making a push. We will say that he spent a lot of time in New Hampshire. Yeah. But the word coming out of the Huntsman camp, our sources are saying that he's got a New Hampshire organization, but he doesn't have one in Iowa. Does not have one in South Carolina, which arguably is just showing that, you know, there's a lot of playing that still needs to be done this far into.
He's coming in late.
He is coming to the game late.
And we remember also, I think there are two players who now I would say are in the top tier. They're both former governors, Mr. Romney and Mr. Pawlenty.
Right. I would agree. Now
they're both former governors. And that goes back to, again, the Republican Governors Association and Haley Barbour.
Right. I would agree with that. Now, the dark horse that everybody's been buzzing about over the past 48 hours has been Chairman and Congressman from Wisconsin, Paul Ryan. Paul Ryan has pretty much come out and stated, I'm not running for president. But there's been a lot of talk. In fact, today or over the weekend, Eric Cantor came out and said, I would like, and I'm paraphrasing, but he came out and just said everything short of, I would like to see Paul Ryan run for president. Paul Ryan, I don't think, is going to make the call to run.
He needs to run for the Senate first. He's going to do that. The last president, I believe I'm correct in this, who ran from the House to succeed was James Garfield.
I believe you're correct.
That's probably correct.
Yeah.
That is correct.
Yeah.
Bob?
And my view is that given his position as the budget chairman and as the author of the Republicans' budget, I think he's got to stay the course on that one. He's got to play that out. Wherever it goes, that's his leadership position right now.
But
I think he has to stay the course on that.
Does Paul Ryan strike you as being the reluctant hero in all this? He's the name that everybody's bringing up. It might even lead to a possible Mitt Romney Paul Ryan ticket. Does that make sense?
My guess is, let me put it this way. I should say my guess. My thought is that the best nominee for vice president that the Republicans can come up with is the junior senator from Florida, Marco Rubio. He has a Cuban background. He is very bright. He's very articulate. He's aggressive. He's active. And he's good looking, and he's got it all. I think he'd be a wonderful vice presidential nominee.
Would that be enough, do you think, Al, to put a Romney ticket over the top to possibly unseat Obama in the White House?
I think whoever the top of the ticket is, Rubio would be a good choice for the number two position. Romney has got huge problems, but he's got a huge treasury.
Yeah.
And you can solve huge problems with lots of money. And that's the reason I think he's the odds-on favorite at this point
to become
the nominee. As a Democrat, that doesn't bother me much. I think the man's got baggage all over the place. Mainly, he's been on every side of every issue, which is baggage all over the place.
Right.
And I think that my dear Democrats, who very often can pull feet out of the jaws of victory, if they were smart, they ought to be able to wrap him up in his own inconsistency pretty effectively.
Well, we're going to take a quick break here, and we're going to talk about that, although I will mention my Tell Me a Story. I'll get it right now because it ties into this. My story was going to be, there's a lot of buzz going around the Republican circles that if Mitt Romney does become the president, his choice could possibly be Condoleezza Rice. Condoleezza Rice's name is starting to float back around inside the Beltway. Not a bad choice. She's well liked, had huge popularity ratings while she was Secretary of State. She's got the international credibility that Mitt Romney also brings to the table.
Well,
that might not be a bad ticket.
And that the current vice president.
And it would
very similar. Very similar.
It would be a good choice.
Well, when we come back, we're getting breaking news out of the Midwest right now in Joplin, Missouri. State officials and local officials are now citing 1,500 deaths in Joplin as a result of the catastrophic tornado that hit that city and the region on Sunday. We're going to talk a little bit about that when we come back here on Backroom Politics. This is Backroom Politics, live from Shelley's Backroom, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, on Blog Talk Radio. Stay with us. On Blog Talk Radio. We're going to talk about with Congressman Al, Bob Hines, and myself, Justin Russell, your moderator. And again, we encourage anybody listening to call in. The number is 619-638-8477. Again, that number is 619-638-8477. We want to talk about some breaking news coming out of Joplin, Missouri right now, and it touches on larger aspect of the discussion. But right now, I need to correct the statement I made before the break. The officials in Missouri and Joplin are now saying that there are 1,500 officially missing, and the death count now is at 118. That's still a huge loss of life on a tornado that is now being argued, was it a heavy F4 or a large F5 tornado, which is the largest tornado is.
And you got to know that if there are 1,500 missing, a whole lot of those are missing because they are in the debris.
Right.
And they're dead, and they've died.
It is a very, very troubling situation in a part of the country that has been hammered so far by tornadoes, the tornadoes that went through, notably the one that hit Tuscaloosa. But Tornado Alley has been very active, on top of the fact that you're dealing with the same region that has been dealing with floods for the past month. It is a very troubling time for natural disasters in the Midwest. I want to talk about it, number one, because, you know, we saw this morning FEMA Administrator Craig Fugate doing the talking head circuit, but he is boots on the ground in Joplin, Missouri. When we look at the responses coming out as a result of the flooding, as a result of the recent tornado activity, from a state and a political aspect, Al, if you were dealing with natural disasters, which you had a tendency to do up in your part of the country, what would your expectations be for a response from the federal government in this? And, in fact, is the federal government doing a good job in this time of crisis?
Well, I dealt with large floods in my district several times, and I must say that when I was first elected, FEMA was most unimpressive. During the 16 years that I was in Congress, that changed dramatically. And then I think when it all happened in New Orleans, I think FEMA got a bum rap. I think in part it was because President Bush kind of blew some of the PR
right
on the whole thing, flying over and starting late and doing a good job browning and all of that stuff. And that devolved to criticism of FEMA. From everything I've been able to hear, FEMA did a very good job down there.
They did.
And so I think that FEMA is a good agency. It works well. It knows what it's doing. And it's apparently already there, and I think it needs to be there with all four feet.
You know, one of the misconceptions, and I'm going to jump into the discussion here because this is something that I'm very close to in my past life. You know, when we look at FEMA, and arguably I will say that, actually not arguably, I will stand up in the halls of Congress and yell this across a rotunda.
You got to get elected first.
Yeah, that's true, too.
Now, you go in a rotunda and start yelling, but you'll be arrested.
Yeah. Capitol Police will have something to say about that. But the reality is, you know, when we look back, even going back to Katrina, a lot of Americans don't understand the role of FEMA. FEMA is, in fact, a federal support agency. It is not the role of the federal government to actively respond and recover. That is a state and local function inherent to those organizations. That is why we're seeing, you know, FEMA in joint conferences with the emergency management directors of Missouri and the city of Joplin. That is why FEMA comes in. Whenever you see a FEMA response, the first words out of, in this case, Administrator Fugate is, what can we do to help? What do you need? And they bring it in. Go ahead, Bob.
And one of the problems, I think, at Katrina down in Louisiana was both the mayor and the governor were a little slow on the uptake.
Absolutely. The mayor of New Orleans at the time and the governor, Governor Blanco, you know, a lot of criticism. You know, it was Governor Blanco, in my opinion, and I'll say this publicly, who dropped the ball. There's no question in my mind. It is a state inherent state function. Public safety is a local functionality, but Ray Nagin, the mayor of New Orleans at the time of Katrina, did everything possible to come out of harm's way and get as many people as he could. You can tell people and create forced evacuations and mandatory evacuations. You can't force them to leave. In fact, anybody who's been inside a mandatory evacuation knows that when police come by, they say, look, you know you got to get out of here. And if they say, we don't want to go, they take down the name and the next of kin.
Yeah.
And that's all they're allowed to do. They can't force you from your home. I think that, you know, in Katrina, the blame goes to Governor Blanco. I think that FEMA was unnecessarily faulted for its response. And all those familiar with emergency response will tell you that Katrina was a textbook response. FEMA did everything possible. It was the PR moves that made it a fiasco. There's a lot of other, you know, a lot of other factors. Go ahead.
Can I ask you a question?
Sure.
I'm asking it genuinely because I don't know the answer.
No,
What was all the foo-for-all that went on about them having so many mobile homes that weren't used and were sitting idle and da-da-da-da-da? That was the one negative thing that FEMA got criticized for, and I don't know whether it was fair or not.
It wasn't fair. Here's the reality is, you know, within hours after or days after Katrina hit New Orleans, helicopters were flying over these large staging areas of mobile homes that were up in Baton Rouge and up in up in Lafayette. When you look at emergency management, had they moved those into New Orleans, they would have been destroyed. You don't put your emergency response resources at ground zero. You keep them staged in a safe area so once the disaster does clear, you can quickly move those in. So when we look at that and we look at how that plays out, it was a red herring in my opinion. And that's just my opinion of being in emergency management as long as I was. When I look at somebody now, Administrator Fugate, and I'm biased, Administrator Fugate was a great emergency manager in Florida. He's a true hardened firefighter, emergency management, EMS type guy from his days down in Gainesville.
He was on the ground this morning.
Absolutely. This is what he does. This is how the man is wired, and he's doing a great job. But, you know, when we see the damage and the destruction, I mean, one reporter called it was like seeing a nuclear bomb going off. It looks like, one reporter said it looked like Hiroshima in the film you saw out of Hiroshima.
I heard that the winds hit 198 miles an hour. Now,
Easy. Just
think about it. If you have a 50 or 60 mile an hour wind, trees are uprooted, reefs get, you know, roofs come off.
50 mile
an
hour
yeah.
winds shut down Washington, D.C.
Yeah, and so you do that by four times.
Oh.
My God.
My mother tells of a tornado that she was in as a child, and my grandfather took them all down to the basement, and suddenly they found themselves in the middle of the street with their house around them, and everybody seemed okay except my grandmother was bleeding. She had blood running down her forehead, and it turned out that one of her hairpins had stabbed her scalp. And we, you know, so they managed to have to live through. Every single member of the family lived through having their house pulled up and dumped on them in the middle of the street in front of their house. So. That was a tornado we don't even remember.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, this is the most destructive tornado that America's seen since 1957, and is going to be one for the record books, unfortunately. But the reason why I bring this up is FEMA for a long time has been an underfunded, you know, dull knife in the arsenal of the federal government, and politically, out. We look at the functionality, we look at the response, we look at what the capabilities are of such a public safety-oriented organization. Why, and I'm going back to your time in Congress, why is it that FEMA does not get the recognition or the funding it deserves?
Ask the same question about the Coast Guard.
Well, I being a former Coast Guard, I would tell you.
Yeah.
Being a former Coastie, I'll tell you exactly.
Well, it's because nobody expects it to happen. And I think there's a little bit of leftover World War II civil defense kind of attitude that's left to them, but that still hangs on. And people just don't see it as being important until something happens. And we as human beings aren't really very good at projecting that anything bad is going to happen to us. And so let's cut that. We know we have a war here. We got to put money there. We know there are people starving in the ghetto in New York. We'll put money there. And pretty soon there's no money left, so they cut FEMA, they cut the Coast Guard. I think most people don't understand what the Coast Guard does.
I would agree with
that. I'm from Washington State, which has Puget Sound and a coastline, and
right.
I know what the Coast Guard does. But if you're from Wyoming, what good is the Coast Guard to you?
Exactly.
So,
exactly.
You mean to say there's no harbor in Wyoming?
No, but there are a lot of rivers that the Coast Guard has jurisdiction over, and that's going to be a subject for another time, because now you've opened this Pandora's box. I'm going to jump in feet first. We'll talk about the Coast Guard funding in a second, but, you know, FEMA's gotten a lot of attention lately because of the natural disasters in the Midwest, whether it's the floods on the Mississippi or the recent tornado activity, which, by the way, we're still not out of the woods because National Weather Service is predicting another round today of catastrophic tornadoes hitting the region. That being said, Bob, I go back to your days working the Hill. Is why is FEMA the unsung hero? Why won't somebody stand up and take the charge and say, look, when you need them, they're there, but nobody wants to give them the proper funding?
Well, I think Al put his finger on it. There are a lot of things that need to be funded. And when they're looking for places to cut, they look at them and they say, well, we didn't use this last year. There wasn't very much going on in this area last year. Let's reduce the money. And so, in effect, places like FEMA, places like the Coast Guard, places like, you know, other
NOAA, for example.
NOAA is a good example. And what happens is then a problem hits and everybody says, oh my God, what are we going to do? Well, we can't move as fast because we haven't had enough funding. What happens is it's like anything else. You know, there's no doubt about it that we could save a lot of money in a lot of ways in our government. But the fact of the matter is you also have to spend money that you hope you have to allocate money that you hope you don't spend, because you hope that you don't have a Katrina, you don't have these floods. But you have to put the money in place, which means you have to have the people and the equipment
and the expertise.
And even if it just sits there, it's like a fire department. You don't want to have a fire, but you're going to make sure you got a fire truck.
Right. Now,
who lobbies for FEMA?
Well, FEMA has its own government affairs office.
Yeah, but it can't really lobby.
It doesn't. There are organizations that lobby on behalf of FEMA.
It seems to me that this is, you know, I've always found in the lobbying that I do is you go to Republicans and Democrats with different arguments that are not inconsistent. Seems to me one of the things that FEMA has that could really impress Republicans is, and you described it earlier, they don't go in and say, this is what you'll do. They go in and say, how can we help? It's really a federalist kind of operation,
right,
cooperation with the state. That should please most Republicans.
Right.
And then the fact you're doing good for people will get you the Democrats. So you really need to focus your lobbying on what will interest that particular member of Congress.
Well, it's funny because the quote-unquote lobbying organizations, there's organizations like the National Emergency Managers Association, which consists of your state and local emergency management officials who theoretically cannot lobby themselves. The International Association of Emergency Management, IAEM, does the same thing. But their voice goes largely unheard in the halls of Congress, I think, because of the reasons that you both bring up.
The Byrd Amendment, I think, is wrong. He was worried about, I think, primarily the Defense Department and some others who were coming in, and maybe some of the social service agencies coming in and unfairly lobbying Congress. Well, maybe. But the fact is, they're the ones that have both the facts, and they are not ones who have, I'm talking about FEMA now, who have a ready-made cadre to go and move for them, whereas others do. And so I think they're doing their lobbying with one hand tied behind their back.
Yeah, I would expect, just based upon recent experience, let's say Katrina forward, over the last half decade, we have had an unusual amount of floods, tornadoes, other disasters.
Right.
Now, seems to me that this is a situation where even if you are looking for cuts, you don't necessarily go to the emergency management operations, which store and get things ready and are ready to respond, because it's looking more and more like we're getting more and more of these problems. Now, if we expect to have them, we need to make sure that while we may not put everything, you know, the first year, but we have got to make sure that FEMA has the resources they need. If they don't have the resources they need, they cannot respond fully.
Right. Well,
I think they're going to get more funding over the next few years than they might.
Put the money in there, and if they don't use it, if the floods don't come, if the tornadoes don't come, give it back or store it up.
Well, store it up. Leave it there, and you know, you make sure you get your equipment and the money you need in place, the dollars you need in place, the people you need in place. And if one year you put $1 billion into it, but you don't need it, the next year maybe you only put $500 million in. But you have to make sure that in place you are ready.
This is a subject I would love to bring up again, and I think that this is not a story that's going to end today, but I would love to bring this up again on a future show, because the Coast Guard and FEMA are two organizations that definitely fall into the same category, and we'll talk about that in another show.
There's a tornado in Oklahoma right now as we speak.
It is not a situation that's going to get any better in the Midwest. On behalf of Backroom Politics, obviously, Bob, Al, and I, we offer our prayers, our sympathies, and our hope for getting through this really tough time in the Midwest. We urge anybody who's listening, now is the time to really step up. You know, it's ironic. We see millions and hundreds of millions of dollars go to Haiti earthquake. We see tens of millions of dollars go to Japan. But you know what? Now is the time to really bring it home. We urge anybody who's listening, you know what? Text 9099 to the American Red Cross. Give $5. Give $1. Give whatever you can. Your neighbors need it right now. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to close out the show with Tell Me a Story. We will be back in 2 minutes. This is Backroom Politics, live from Shelley's Back Room on Blog Talk Radio. Stay with us.
East of the sun and west of the moon, we'll build a dream house of love. Stars will find. Jackson and West Alabama, dear, just you and I will build a dream house.
And we're live back in Shelley's back room in Washington, D.C. This is Backroom Politics on Blog Talk Radio. It is the home stretch now. It is, as always, our free form. It is where we just go around the table and find out what's the latest gossip here inside the Beltway. It is time for Tell Me a Story. Bob, you've asked to go first. Bob, tell me a story.
Well, for the last 6 weeks at least, we have been talking on almost every show about the need to raise the debt ceiling so the government can finance itself and continue to move forward.
Right.
As a part of that, we have to have a plan about what we're going to do, because it's very clear that there's not going to be an increase in the debt ceiling without some kind of a plan to hold the deficit down and reduce it. The only place that a deficit plan has been put out and laid on the table is by the House Republicans, led by their budget chairman, Paul Ryan.
Right.
It's passed the House. It will not pass the Senate. It
right.
will be voted on this week. But the point is, to me, the Democrats, both the Democrats in the Senate, where they're the majority, and the White House, have not put anything on the table.
Right.
There's a lot of talk, a lot of smoke, a lot of mirrors, but there's no substance in it. And I think it's fair to say that the Democrats are playing with fire. They ought to put something on the table. Look, it's going to be controversial, whatever they put on the table. That's legitimate, just like Mr. Ryan's proposal is controversial. But the Democrats have to stop beating up on Paul Ryan's program and put something on the table themselves.
Right.
They haven't done it.
Right. Well, and arguably, this goes back to something we've talked about in days past, shows past. There's no sense of leadership coming out of the other side of the House.
Or the Senate, or the White House.
Agreed.
Nothing
Agreed.
Is happening, and they need to do it.
Do you see an option coming down the pike other than the Obama presidential budget request that was submitted and pulled back and then resubmitted?
I haven't the faintest idea what they're doing, but it ain't very helpful.
Al?
I am in the unfortunate position of not being able to disagree with Bob too much. I would add, however, and this we've talked about before, the White House has had several plans with bipartisan input, the Simpson plan and others, and they have not done it. And I think having not done it, it puts guys like me in a very difficult position to defend them. So I won't. What I will do is, my story is, FEMA ain't going to have any trouble getting appropriations this year.
Really? From your mouth to God's ears, Al. From, you know, truly, it is truly one of the unsung heroes inside federal government. Both the Coast Guard and FEMA, they've always been there since, you know, in the Coast Guard's term since 1790. They've always been there. They've always met the needs of the nation. FEMA, in its existence, has always been there for the citizens of the United States. Bob?
And it may just be that with all the problems they've had to face in the last few years, legislators as well as the public may begin to realize how important they are and how significant it is that we make sure they have the funding they need.
That's the underlying thought for my story.
Well, let me tell you my story. Traditionally, FEMA, until the creation of the Department of Homeland Security, FEMA was a standalone agency, direct report to the president. After Katrina, there was talk that FEMA would come out and they would put it back under Chief Paulson and make it an independent authority, direct report to the president. They have since modified that the head of FEMA does have direct line to the president, but still falls under the authority of the Secretary of Homeland Security. My story is that as a result of what we've seen over the past month, new talk and new discussions, and there's a strong possibility that we will see FEMA come out of the Department of Homeland Security and become a standalone agency once again. That talk has been going on. We've got somebody here in the FEMA gallery that's disagreeing with us who would know. I'm telling you, I think that debate's going to come up, and I think it's got some legs this time. But we'll talk about that in a future show. And what I will do now is, again, urge everybody who's listening, if you have a moment, if you have a second, give to the American Red Cross, give to the Salvation Army. They need the money now more than ever. And our thoughts go to our friends out in Joplin, Missouri, out in the Midwest, and the flood victims along the Mississippi River Valley. Cannot tell you how much we feel for you guys, and we're here for you. So, again, give if you can, support what you can, but now's the time when Americans got to stand up for Americans. Now's the time to do it. On behalf of Congressman Al Swift, the Honorable Bob Hines, Ralph Winnie, who's on his way to the G8, hey, Ralph, if you're listening, call in next week from Paris. I'm sure it'll be a cheap phone call for 2 hours. I'm your moderator, Justin Russell. This has been Backroom Politics, live from Shelley's Backroom, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital. We will be back on Blog Talk Radio next Tuesday, 4 to 6 Eastern Daylight Time. Have a great week, everybody.
See you next week.
Thank you.